The jam for the two pieces of toast we offered yesterday is here. I've been waiting for another article by Thomas Green to come out, and here it is. The Democrats' secret recipe for failure. Again, this is something you can offer to your Bernie-loving, Biden-voting friends if they've been pestering you lately on social media. This is your opportunity to pester them back. I hope you enjoy. Donald Trump's latest tax scandal and dismal performance debating Joe Biden might sink his campaign, but I wouldn't bet on it. His struggle with COVID-19 might too, but if he survives, I wouldn't bet on that either. The Democrats look like a party that's afraid to win. They are tweaking their heirloom recipe for failure at the polls, or failure in office if they should get lucky with voters, even though it has yielded one quiet fiasco after another during the past quarter century. Getting beaten often seems the kinder outcome. Democratic success on Election Day has yielded disappointment in American government from the early 1990s right through to the present. Still, there are valuable lessons in store for those who would review the disheartening path from Bill Clinton's first term to Joe Biden's 2020 campaign. Let's reset the clock. In 1993, the candidate Bill Clinton promised to be tough on crime and good for civil rights. That was risky language because tough on crime is code for putting black men behind bars. Just imagine Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan or some generic Arkansas good old boy saying it, and you know exactly what it means. Unless, apparently, that Arkansas good old boy is a prominent Democrat, in which case it has to be an innocent figure of speech. And yet, what Clinton delivered as president was, in fact, a lot more black men behind bars. America reached new levels of authoritarianism by way of the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 and the Violence Against Women Act also of 1994, which greatly increased police budgets, criminal sentences, and prison capacity. Soon he would crack the seal on austerity, first with NAFTA, a Reagan wish list that shipped desirable manufacturing jobs overseas so that American employers could cut wages and benefits, then threaten to relocate to Mexico if workers didn't take what they were offered. Ding, ding, ding. Next, we got the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act of 1996, designed to end welfare as we know it, more code for doing dirt to black people, which drove the least fortunate among us out of their homes and into the streets. Luckily, there were plenty of cops to welcome them. Thus did Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty become Bill Clinton's war on the poor. He got a pass on bigotry and class warfare because he wasn't a Republican, even though the outcomes of his domestic policy would have tickled Reagan or Nixon or George Wallace. It's almost as if he had secretly meant the racist subtext embedded in his innocent figures of speech. Clinton's failure to secure a public health care scheme or insurance subsidy for the many millions who lost employer-provided health coverage during his tenure would complete the demoralizing triumvirate plaguing all working Americans for the past 25 years. The decline of manufacturing jobs and their replacement with low-paying service sector gigs, unaffordable health care, and reduced entitlements for the needy. Workers began drowning in a sea of consumer credit, which helped them keep up appearances, at least for a while. The president served Republican Party interests like a house pet and was rewarded with public loathing and articles of impeachment. He never got wise. But, Thomas, he did make his donors happy. Clinton moved the Democratic Party to a center-right position in the name of national unity and economic progress, but really on behalf of the national plutocracy, which had shifted its gaze from manufacturing toward new tech, from the Rust Belt to Silicon Valley, we might say. Republicans who had long occupied the center-right position were driven further along the X-axis by Newt Gingrich and became openly Calvinist. That offended the American left, which made Al Gore's uninspiring campaign trickier than it needed to be. He lost to the even less inspiring George W. Bush for many reasons, among them a disgusted left wing that stayed home or maybe voted for Nader, but ultimately because he was too eager to concede, which he did in the name of national unity. He probably thought it was a noble gesture, But I saw a man unwilling to fight on behalf of the voters. I wanted to hear him vow to hang on with broken, bleeding fingernails to ensure that every vote was counted, but he caved. He was as weak as Clinton, as was Bush Jr., by the way. He might have walked like a cartoon tough guy, swinging his arms stiffly in little arcs as if to accommodate imaginary six-shooters, but he swallowed everything Cheney and Rumsfeld fed him and politely asked for more. The Democrats hardly have a monopoly on weak presidents. Think Ronald Reagan gazing blankly into the middle distance, ducking shouted questions, waiting for Nancy to prompt him. The art of never learning. The clever and criminally inclined Richard Nixon gave us social instability, open class warfare, stagflation, Black Panthers, university buildings on fire, which so frightened the national plutocracy that we stopped getting candidates who seemed too bright. Instead, we got a gentle peanut farmer and Sunday school teacher, then a mediocre actor, then the mediocre actor's sidekick. Ultimately, we got the underachieving son of the mediocre actor's sidekick. Naturally, the Democratic Party hastened to perfect its master recipe for opposing Republicans no one likes very much with Democrats no one likes at all. I'm looking at you, Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, Walter Mondale, and Michael Dukakis. Only the Democrats could have challenged George W. Bush with someone even weaker and less appealing. John Kerry caught the national unity bug early. He too spoke about common ground. He said he'd be happy to offer cabinet posts to Republicans. On July 29, 2004, during the convention in Boston, he waded to the lectern and said, I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty. He gave a feeble military-style salute. His hand came up in two floaty movements, then drifted back down. Anyone who has served knows that you don't salute out of uniform and that there are a total of two arm movements, both of them crisp. As a former Navy officer, he had to know it. His pseudo-salute was cringeworthy because he was clearly ashamed to make a cheesy gesture to please a crowd, but make it he did. And his words, reporting for duty, he sounded like a summer intern introducing himself to the partners and not very confidently. This was not a guy who would fight for me or anyone I cared about. He talked like a book. I didn't mind that he lost. Junior was no worse than Clinton or Gore or Kerry. Today, Joe Biden is trying to optimize the recipe by channeling Barack Obama. He's under pressure from his campaign people, from the media, and from prominent liberals to get the old band back together in hopes of catching the eye and endorsement of suburbanite influencers like Cindy McCain and Colin Powell. Enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders during the early primaries must have alarmed the party elite, who always prefer losing to winning with someone they can't control. But soon after Bernie's strong debut, something happened. What I don't know, and the ticket began to smell of Gore and Kerry and stale fabrics and denture adhesive, and of Obama, who is said to be an improvement, although I would disagree. Obama wards is the wrong direction for America. Yes, I know how popular he is. Hear me out. Twirling, twirling, twirling toward freedom. President Obama's timidity when he assumed office with a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate cannot be explained rationally. He could have accomplished a lot for ordinary people in those first 2 years, but he rolled over for a menacing clan of bankers, several of whom deserve to be prosecuted, if not crucified, for Big Pharma and the health insurance racket and for Republicans in Congress. He didn't even try to attach a public option to the Affordable Care Act. He avoided taking any substantial political risks on behalf of the people who elected him, and they made their disapproval known by punishing him at the polls. His electoral vote count fell from 365 against John McCain in 2008 to 332 against Mitt Romney, the weaker opponent, in 2012. I admired much of Obama's foreign policy, especially after the cynicism of the Bush-Cheney years, but in terms of domestic politics, his greatest skills were speaking and virtue signaling. He had always wished to see a higher minimum wage. He sincerely hoped for a national infrastructure repair program that could have employed millions. He would have liked to increase the earned income credit and make food stamps available to more Americans, he had every intention of shutting Guantanamo Bay. He spoke in favor of sensible gun control, especially after the Sandy Hook atrocity, and he shed tears. He said lovely things about young Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old black kid shot dead in Florida on February 26, 2012, but he did nothing. There was an epidemic of black lives taken through police violence during his second term. I have to point out that Trump's record here is no worse. This list, while shocking, is not exhaustive. It covers slightly more than 2 years' time, and there are gaps. Eric Garner, New York City, July 17, 2014. Michael Brown, Ferguson, Missouri, August 9, 2014. Ezell Ford, Los Angeles, California, August 11, 2014. Michelle Casseau, Phoenix, Arizona, August 14, 2014. Tanisha Anderson, Cleveland, Ohio, November 13, 2014. Tamir Rice, aged 12, Cleveland, Ohio, November 22, 2014. Natasha McKenna, Fairfax, Virginia, February 8, 2015. Megan Hockaday, Oxnard, California, March 28, 2015. Walter Scott, North Charleston, South Carolina, April 4, 2015. Freddie Gray, Baltimore, Maryland, April 19, 2015. Quintonio LeGreer, Chicago, Illinois, December 26, 2015. Betty Jones, Chicago, Illinois, December 26, 2015. Alton Sterling, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, July 5th, 2016. Philando Castile, St. Paul, Minnesota, July 6th, 2016. Deborah Danner, New York City, October 18, 2016. How many of those names did Barack Obama say? I remember only a few. What number of violent deaths did he need to see before he would act? What sacrifice frequency for black Americans was required to move him? We still don't know. As I've mentioned before, I recall him speaking on July 30th, 2020, eulogizing the late U.S. Representative John Lewis of Georgia. The former president promised us that one day, when we do finish that long journey toward freedom, when we do form a more perfect union, whether it's years from now, or decades, or even if it takes another two centuries, John Lewis will be a founding father of that fuller, fairer, better America. He sounded ready to condone two more centuries of racial injustice so long as it doesn't affect him or the people he holds close. He has lost touch with regular citizens. He's in the magic kingdom of movie stars and tech billionaires, a luxurious soundproof envelope where a stunningly tone-deaf Michelle thought it reasonable to whine about how unfulfilling she found her COVID-diminished social life during the very period when the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor had inspired ordinary Americans, black and white, to risk catching a deadly virus just so they could risk catching a police baton upside their heads. Barack Obama is a gifted orator. He delivered memorable speeches, but I could never shake the feeling that he was addressing his future biographers first and me second. Certainly, he was presidential, and back in 2008, I was proud of America for electing him. He never failed to exhibit noble dispositions, yet whenever Republicans in Congress showed the least bit of spine, he yielded. He wasn't foolish or selfish or uncaring, but he never fought for anything or anyone, not even his third Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, because Mitch McConnell had put up his fists. He kept the lid on a federal investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. That's interesting. Including irregular contact between agents of the Russian government and Trump's campaign personnel and advisors, because the Senate Majority Leader wouldn't support him publicly. Every day he handed McConnell his lunch money, and every day McConnell gave him a swirly regardless. I used to call a swirly a noogie, I think. Dear viewers and listeners, you'll have to put it in the comments what you called them. Obama added some spice to the recipe, but little else. He's an establishment Democrat to the core, and yet he moved people. That's an extraordinary combination, as if Walter Mondale had somehow become exciting. But in terms of tangible results, President Obama came in well below expectations. Perhaps reaching the White House was the accomplishment, in his mind at least, or perhaps he choked under the burden of being a black man at the pinnacle of white society with everyone's eyes on him all the time. The slightest blunder might have been trumpeted as proof of racist myths, so he never took full possession of the office. For 8 years, he kept the plastic on the sofa cushions, and for that, we've all been punished. Trump's victory is in part a reaction against the Obama administration's timid domestic agenda, which means that, painful as it might be for some Democrats to acknowledge, President Trump is a major part of Barack Obama's political legacy, the lemming strategy. Of course, Hillary failed to defeat Trump in 2016. She didn't work the swing states. She expected all the little flyover and Rust Belt Ewoks to vote for her because, really, who could they vote for? Trump was unthinkable. So she hung out with George Clooney and Barbara Streisand and Oprah Winfrey, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt, and toasted her own good fortune. What a blow she must have felt on election night. It should surprise no one, then, that in 2019, House Democrats whipped up a little amuse-bouche to impeach the most corrupt president in American history. They were afraid of overdoing their oaths to the Constitution, apparently, and they were afraid they might confuse the American people. Mostly, they were afraid. They drew the articles of impeachment so narrowly that people rightly wondered what all the fuss was about. They allowed potential witnesses to dismiss subpoenas and withhold documents. They overlooked bribery, extortion, obstruction of justice, campaign finance abuses, and tax fraud. Trump would still have been acquitted, but at least the full menu of crimes and sleaze could have been laid on the table. That would have muted the Republican chorus with its relentless refrain claiming falsely that there was no crime, hence no grounds to impeach. Even Charlie Brown would have anticipated that move, but Nadler, Schiff, and Pelosi did not. This is me talking. I would have to echo what Crystal Ball said on Hill Rising. They couldn't have laid that all out there because they would then have shown themselves to be culpable too. They would have had to fess up to their own garbage. Joe Biden wasn't the only one to have a son in Ukraine. Nancy Pelosi also did. Yep, a lot of graft would have been exposed on the Democratic side of the aisle if they had pulled all of Trump's skeletons out of the closet. Back to the story. We need forceful change in domestic politics, and we need it today. America is dazed, stumbling. There's no justice for black citizens, and there won't be. We've got wildfires, hurricanes, floods, a severe economic contraction, and a deadly pandemic. I see the fist of an angry God poised to squash a once great nation like a bug, and Kamala and Joe are not up to the challenge. A President Biden will be cautious and inclined to ride the most popular and obvious political currents safely to shore. I've said this before. He's got long-standing ties to the financial and consumer credit rackets, and many of his senior campaign people are former lobbyists, industry flacks, and banking alums. Harris, meanwhile, is much loved by Silicon Valley's tech titans. She's also loved by Wall Street. She would not be running with Biden unless she had first persuaded establishment Democrats in the Clinton/Obama wing, big money donors, K Street lobbyists, and Park Avenue liberals that she will remain loyal if, heaven forbid, Joe should die in office, making her president. If Biden does get elected, I'd give it slightly over a year before something happens to him that makes it impossible for him to continue in his office. Meet the old boss. Many of America's working poor who lean Democratic have voted, and will again vote, Republican because educated Democrats no longer respect or even recognize them. The elites have alienated many who hold low-status jobs by flaunting their privileges and exclusive pleasures. Their snotty TED conferences and veganism, their woke Burning Man retreats and fastidious recycling and Whole Foods markets, by welcoming applause lines like Michelle's famous "When they go low, we go high." they can't understand that going high is a deeply offensive slogan. Working Americans hear an echo in their minds. They hear smug liberals with money and enviable diplomas taunting them, saying, "We're better than you proles." I would jettison that loathsome jingle from the known universe if I could, but it has stuck. We face a choice between a reckless saboteur and kleptocrat who defiles the Oval Office and spits on humane social values, but who is also wrecking a political ecosystem that many people have come to despise. Those whose incomes are barely adequate, who will never earn a surplus, who occupy a permanent lane a few paychecks ahead of the bailiff and the repo man, now hate what the American economic system has become. And I can't emphasize this enough. They are Republicans and Democrats. On the opposing team, we find an amiable pair of establishment collaborators whose every word and gesture whispers handmaidens to the national plutocracy. There's no reason why anyone except a millionaire or a Republican should wish to vote for them. If the Democrats win this one, they'll send Trump back to his natural habitat in the world of entertainment, where he will cry and spew and spin conspiracy theories and undermine the Biden administration, which, in turn, will permit itself to be undermined instead of swatting him like the gnat he is. There will be a lot of talk about national unity and reconciliation and what's best for America. That's because Democrats who refuse to be bullied or who take troll bait also invite conflict, which displeases the plutocrats whose corporations and investments perform so much better when we all passively mind our places. With a neoliberal centrist in the Oval Office, we'll get 4 or 8 more years of the economic and social policies that inspired, no, compelled, Americans to elevate Donald Trump from C-list TV personality to President of the United States. Kamala and Joe will not fix this mess if they win. They will ignore the permanent underclass as all politicians do. A Biden administration will only draw anger and resentment from working Americans and set up for another Trump in 2024, if we're lucky, or a more competent demagogue with even darker intentions, a Recep Tayyip Erdogan or a Rodrigo Duterte, say, if we're not. This might seem perverse, but it's no less true. Donald is the genuine American candidate, the organic choice. He's the music man. He's Flannery O'Connor's Bible salesman. Can't you just hear 76 trombones playing him on and off the stage? He points us toward what H.L. Mencken called the American lust for the hideous, the delight in ugliness for its own sake. Donald, more than most, is willing to appear grotesque in order to remain popular. That is his superpower. When we recall the changes that have demoted the working class to the working poor, the incalculable wealth and influence derived from tech fortunes and their effects on Washington politics and government regulations, and the failure of Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama to pursue social justice with enough zeal to avert a national descent into political grand guignol, we can no longer deny that President Donald Trump is a faithful expression of who we are and what we as a people desire.